Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Hope you guys are all having a great week. A lot going on this month. It's Brain Injury Awareness Month, so thank you for tuning in. You've come to the right place. I found out later that it was Women's History Month, and I was surprised. I didn't know I thought every month was Women's History Month. I've got a history. I'm a woman, but I'm glad to know that we're being recognized. So that too. Happy St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. And when is it? Sunday, I believe, is the first day of spring. And if you haven't set your clocks correctly from last weekend, then you've been late all week, right? An hour late? If no one's caught you yet, my co-host Karen last week informed me that if it was 7 o'clock last week, we'd be at 8 o'clock this week. So an hour later, I guess. In any case, I'm glad that you guys are all here tonight. For those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a We recovery program because it is in the We that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice. I'm here every Wednesday. If you'd like to know more about me, you can check out my website, inaflash.org. How quickly our lives can change, right? Inaflash.org. Same thing if you want to like me on Facebook. It's facebook.com/inaflash.org. And you can, I encourage you to like Brain Injury Radio as well. I'm going to actually play a song tonight first by a fellow recovering brain injury person, woman, long as we're recognizing women's history too and brain injury, this lady fits both bills, Christabel Braden, excuse me, I'm just, my guest and I are here talking, but Christabel Braden is a brain injury survivor. You can find her music at ChristabelBraden.com or check her out on Facebook and like her. And her song is very poignant. It's called More to Me. So before I bring on my guest, I'm going to play a quick song by Christabel Braden. And I think this will resonate with all of you who are survivors out there. And then I'll be back with a guest I'm very excited about tonight. Be right back.
Who have I become? Wrapped up in a memory. Where do I belong? It's been so long, and every time I try to make sense of anything, find that I'm stressed about everything. This isn't who I used to be. When the waves came and when the storm raged, found myself falling into the ground. When the wind blew, that's when it fell through, and I don't know how to turn it around. I know there's more to me than the wreckage you see. There's more to be. I'm still on the journey. I'm still on the journey. When did I become my own worst enemy? Where did I go wrong? Anything, I'll never come back. I'll never be the person that I want to be. When the waves came and when the storm raged, found myself falling into the ground. When the wind blew, that's when it fell through, and I don't know.
That was Christabel Braden, and she has a new release coming out next week, I believe. I think she's in Tennessee this week finishing her latest album. Again, she's a brain injury survivor and warrior, and I hope you enjoyed the song, because there's certainly more to all of us than our brain injury, but we're here because it's amazing. It is getting better. But, you know, everybody's heard of heart disease, cancer, diabetes. I've been here, I think this is the beginning of my 12th year. And if I went out and asked John Q. Public or Jane Q. Public what they knew about brain injury, when I started, very few people knew anything about brain injury. And with 2.8 million people a year affected by brain injury, that really blew me away. Going on 12 years later, it's gotten a bit better, but we're here to make sure that that momentum keeps going forward and that people are aware. I'm really excited about my guest tonight. You know, I've been blessed to have a lot of great guests over the years. And I haven't really had the opportunity to talk to them until our interview. and maybe, if anything, just a brief conversation before. But Ray and I talked when we were booking this show months ago, it seems like, and there were so many coincidences between us, and we really hit it off and have become good friends, I think. I think he would agree. We'll check with him when he comes on. And I've gotten an opportunity to talk to his wife, Patty, who is charming, wonderful. Anyway, these people are the salt of the earth, and it felt like getting together with family when I've talked to them. And so I'm really happy to have Ray on the show tonight. Ray Ciancaglini is a former professional boxer and renowned concussion awareness advocate who has battled Parkinson's syndrome and pugilistica dementia, or CTE, as we know it, the direct result of improper management of concussion during his boxing career. Ray travels the country lecturing collegiate athletes and medical students about proper concussion management and the possible repercussions of circumventing appropriate concussion protocol. He also speaks at TBI conferences and medical institutions about living with a traumatic brain injury and stage 2 dementia. All of his speaking engagements are free of charge. Ray was instrumental in getting passed into New York State law the Concussion Management Awareness Act of 2010 and was a contributor to the 1996 Professional Boxing Safety Act. Ray is a member of the Rochester, New York Boxing Hall of Fame and the Geneva, New York Sports Hall of Fame. His most notable awards are the Hickok Hero Award, the Golden Glove Heart Award, and the Jerry Flynn Courage Award. His greatest award, however, is knowing that he's making a difference in the lives of young athletes and TBI survivors. Ray's life story is captured in a recent book on Amazon, Second Impact, The Ray Ciancaglini Story by Andy Siegel, Esquire. He's an attorney. And we'd like to further thank GTX Smart Soul. And I would encourage you to see Ray's website, thesecondimpact.com. For those of you who are new around here, I always put the relevant website in my program notes. So this show is posted on about 40 places all over social media. If you are not with a pen right now and you can't write it down, that's why I mention I always put it in the program notes. If you are listening by phone, you can always find my program notes at braininjuryradio.com. or at my own personal website, inaflash.org, or reach out to me to find the link almost anywhere for this show, and in that you'll find The Second Impact. That will also not only tell you about Ray, but there is a place that will direct you to his book on Amazon, kind of a shortcut over to Amazon to find his book, and I really encourage you to read it. It's short, sweet, and to the point, which I like. And a lot of us who have a brain injury like that, because if the font is too small and the book is too long, frankly, we often can't hang in there for it. But Ray tells a very personal yet universally appealing story, giving information that is very important. It doesn't seem like that long ago that concussion was considered a traumatic brain injury or a TBI. People just said, you know, I remember when I was young, shine a flashlight in their eyes and don't let them go to sleep or they might wake up dead. And that was the end of it. Go on with your life. The truth is much more painful and deep than that. And we're going to talk about that tonight, as well as having a good time, because this guy has a great sense of humor. So with that, I'm honored to bring on my guest, Ray.
Hello, Tim.
How you doing?
Very good, very good. And I've been waiting for this evening, and it's here. And I'll tell you, I consider it a great honor to be part of tonight's radio broadcast. And you know something, Tim? Every successful boxer knows the importance of having a knowledgeable and dedicated staff work their corner. And the great Muhammad Ali was guided by legendary trainers, Angelo Dundee and Bundini Brown. And I'll tell you, we are so fortunate to have Kim Justice work in the corner of traumatic brain injury. Thank you, Kim, for all that you do for so many. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ray. That's sweet of you to say. You know, both of us had other plans when life happened, right? And
yeah,
we wound up refinding our purpose. Wasn't what we were planning on, wasn't what we thought we wanted, but became exactly what we needed after the fact. And I say that I used to work for big bucks and now I work for soul bucks. And it's really been rewarding, as we talked about, you know, what you've been doing and what I've been doing, helping raise awareness and knowing that if we can even save one person, but as many times and as much as you and me talk, there's probably been more than one person. And if we can impact people's lives in a positive way and save them from going down the road that we have, then that's something to be very grateful for.
Yeah.
Why don't we start at the beginning? I kind of like to just start at the beginning. When you were a kid, a lot of people, you know, will take their career if they're an astronaut or whatever they are, and they wanted to do that ever since they were a little kid. Tell us how you became interested in being a boxer.
Well, I'm going to divulge my age here. And my desire to become a boxer began way back in 1957. I was 6 years old, and I used to hang out at my grandparents' Italian restaurant in a small city on Seneca Lake, the Finger Lakes in New York. And it was a Friday night, and the bar room was packed with patrons to watch the Gillette Friday night fights on the large black and white television above the bar. And, you know, back then, not everybody had a television. So when those fights came on, it packed the bar room. But that night was special because local from Syracuse middleweight champion Carmen Basilio was fighting. And I watched, you know, as the crowd roared with every punch Carmen threw. And that night made such an impression on me. After the fight, I ran to the basement, and I filled a laundry bag full of dirty linens. I then climbed on top of a pickle barrel, because I was so small, and hung it up from a steam pipe and started using it as a punching bag. Well, before I knew it, my grandmother came down and asked me what I was doing. And I said, "Grandma, I'm Carmen Basilio." Well, she said, "Never mind that boxing. You better go to college. And I'll get back in the bar room and help your grandfather." She gave me a little swat on the behind, and the rest is history. That's how it started. Yeah.
Now, Grandma was not down with that idea, but your grandpa was a little bit different.
Yeah.
How did he react when he found out?
Well, I should say we snuck. So we used to get the old oven mittens that they used to make the pizzas with, and we put those on and we'd spar in the basement. But we'd have a keen ear to upstairs and to make sure that, you know, Grandma didn't come down and catch us. She absolutely didn't want me doing anything with boxing. She wanted me to go to college, along with my mother. I think they wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer, but it wasn't in my cards,
They always do, don't they?
It's nice to wish the best, but who's to say what the best is? If your success is happiness, then that's my look on it. But
you were happy as a little guy because your grandpa and you had a little secret gone, and so you would sneak down the basement and do your sparring. So what happened? How were you able to come out then and actually start boxing? It didn't start with boxing, did it? It started with some, an Italian boy in New York. You were into some scrapping incidences.
Yes. Well, God gives us all an ability somewhere. And he gave me an ability to be good with my hands. And I had this thing about bullies. I just never liked to see anybody being picked on. So here I was fighting everybody's fight. And sooner or later, you know, that gets you into trouble. And that's exactly what it did. And one police officer, he answered the call a few times. And he said, "Geez, you know, every time I come to these fracases, you're involved." And he got me introduced to some people that were involved in boxing, and I was 14 years old. And that's where I started.
May I interrupt you for a minute? Do you mind if I share something that you told me wasn't in the book? Because it is relevant in this platform.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You have the free rein to do anything tonight. Okay? Whatever you think.
Yeah, my show, right? What, are you going to punch me?
I just want everybody to hear the truth. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that I encourage you all to read the book, but when I'm joking with Ray about scrapping, the things that I read about in the book, and then I'll tell you something that Ray shared with me that is not in the book, is that, as he just said, he really didn't like bullying. And so he shared with me that at his school, there was a class of developmentally disabled kids, and that some of the other children can be very cruel, were not very nice to some of these kids. And a lot of the fights that Ray got into were defending people, whether it was kids from school who had a developmental disability or a kid on the street and somebody was trying to turn them upside down and get the lunch money out of their pockets. Ray was really the champion of those who needed to be defended, at least as we read it in the book, and as that story I just shared with you that is not in the book, most of that scrapping was not done with him going to look for it. In fact, one of the comments that that officer he was just talking about made when he said that you're usually involved is that he doesn't go out looking for trouble. You don't go out looking for trouble, but you sure find it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think, you know, that was noble, but you were also a tough kid. So when you were beating up some of these bullies, you know, they weren't looking so good afterwards. So this officer who comes a couple of times and catches you decides, and he was probably one of the angels, one of the first angels that popped in, because instead of throwing you in jail, he wanted to redirect your energy a little bit, and now you go on.
Yeah, it was a blessing in disguise. And it's funny, the Little Leaguer, I only played one game of Babe Ruth before I got into trouble. And I remember the coach saying something that kind of hurt me. And he pointed to one of the shortstop, and he said, "That young man has a real nose for the ball." And he looked at me and he says, "You, young man, have a nose for trouble." And, you know, it was, I guess, misunderstood in a way, because he didn't know what kind of trouble. He just heard that I liked to scrap and didn't know the particulars of it. So, I don't know, Kim, youth is, sometimes things can be so misunderstood. And if you don't have a father figure at home or a big brother, it can be tough because you have to mold your own way. Everything you learn, you have to learn the hard way. Nobody's telling you much. So, and that was the case with me. I only wish I had a big brother, and I had a nice dad, but I never saw him. And that's so important. And today, I kind of smother my kids because of that. They're just so important.
Well, you learn from experience what you didn't have. So that's a good thing. So the officer was trying to get you to redirect your energy from fighting to doing something more productive, hoped that you'd be able to find that on the baseball field, but that coach, as you say, misunderstood what you were about, and you didn't really get a chance or want a chance after your feelings were hurt. And so where then did the Monsignor come in?
Well, actually, we go back to that incident in, I think it was 13. Yeah, we go back to that incident where after one of the practices, we were on the way home. And again, I saw somebody get pushed, and there it was. And I happened to hit this older kid, and the lady came out on the porch. She started yelling. She's going to call the police. They call it the cops then, right? And she did. So we all ran, and we thought we got away with it. And I came back to practice the next day, and the police car pulled up. Next thing you know, they're calling me in. And I said, they said, "Ray, what happened last night?" Of course, being a kid, you don't tell the truth. And I said, "What? I don't know anything about that. You don't know anything about the fracas that happened down the street?" I said, "Absolutely not." And they said, "Well, how many number 13s are there on this team?" Pause. They got me because I had my still had my uniform on, number 13, and that's how they. So how smart was I? And yeah, that's when he told me, yeah, "I think you're done here with baseball." Okay, and so he took me to a place where they trained, and the first thing they saw was my hands. They saw I had big hands for a little kid, and I guess they felt that that's a good sign of a puncher, and it usually is. And from that moment on, I just kept moving up the ladder, and I enjoyed it. I really did, and I kept up my homework. I began to not see trouble so much, and all that was great. And I was even a high honor student, Kim. But I had the first concussion. Was in Buffalo, New York, and I caught this right hook to the back of my head, and it dazed me. And I got through the fight, but I felt this fatigue and a headache, but I didn't know anything about it. Nobody ever told us anything about concussion. I didn't even know I had one. So I was signed to fight again in Syracuse the following week, 7 days later. And I didn't want to miss that opportunity, but I trained with those little nagging symptoms. And, you know, when I climbed in the ring in Syracuse, I knew something wasn't right. I was lethargic and kind of mechanical. I wasn't as sharp as usual. And sure enough, I got my bell rung again for the second time in 1 week, only this one really stung. You know, I'd never been knocked down, and I didn't in this fight either. I went the distance, but I should have known something in the second or third round. I went back to the corner and vomited in the corner water bucket. I was very nauseated. And after the fight, I had this fog, and I carried that right through to the post-fight interview, where at times they even had to remind me that I had lost. Now, that there didn't stop there. I started missing classes, sleeping like 14 hours a day, failing every course. And then I developed this disdain for authority. I was starting to have behavioral problems, and I never had that in school. And the teachers didn't understand either. They couldn't understand what's going on with this kid, you know, with his studies and behavior. But, you know, I know what it was. I know what it was now, but we didn't then. And it was a thing called second impact syndrome. And that is when an individual gets a concussion and doesn't take care of it, and then gets another concussion on top of it. That's where every time you're going to get some serious brain damage because you didn't let the first one heal. And that's what really happened to me. It changed my life, changed my whole life. And it carried through right till today where, you know, it's catapulted into more serious conditions.
Right. Well, again, so second impact is when you go back too soon when one concussion hasn't healed. And there's a lot of science out there now. There wasn't back then, as I said at the beginning of the show. You know, the way concussions were handled in the past, I remember coming over my handlebars, riding my bicycle as a little girl down a hill and hitting some gravel. And it was back when we had those old banana seats and those high up handlebars, and I put on my brakes and skidded on the gravel and flew over the handlebars and got what we called a big goose egg on my forehead back then. And you know, my mom put some ice on it, and basically the advice that all of the doctors gave back then is don't let them go to sleep or they might wake up dead. You know what I mean? And then you're back to business, you know? And that's pretty much what they were doing with the athletes. You know, whether you got knocked out or you just, as you say, got your bell rung, got hit hard and were somewhat disoriented. For those who might not know what get your bell rung means, that means a person isn't necessarily knocked out. They're just hit hard enough that they're disoriented. And if you go back too soon and play before your brain has had time to heal, that's one of the things that, you know, we're not able to see. If, you know, back in baseball, if you slid into home plate and, you know, got gravel burn, you know, a gravel rash up your leg, you can see that wound. And you can see how long it takes to heal. You can't see when your brain gets bruised, gets slammed against your skull, because, again, the brain is like a cage, a spiny cage, and the skull, and the brain rests inside the skull, and it's like a fist of jelly in there. And so when you have impact, whether it's a hit from outside in your case, then that brain slams against the skull and causes bruising, among other things. To make it simple, I'm not a doctor, I'm just passing on what I've heard. And so, but we can't see that. We can't see that bruising or that damage that's happened to the brain. Even sometimes little bleeds, you know, happen because people get hit hard enough. But you don't see it. And when you said, you know, then we come to, okay, you can't see it. What about recognizing it? And you mentioned a couple of things about not feeling up to par when you went in the next time. But I'd like to have you help me point out that when you have gotten a concussion or gotten your bell rung, your judgment isn't as sharp. And so yes, that night, you know, the comment that you made is, I know now what was going on then. Where I'd like to go is back then, when you didn't know what was going on, you were doing things like acting out, you know, having impulse control and memory issues and sleeping a lot, neurofatigue, we call it, and symptoms. But it seems like to me that you're working through the symptoms but not really realizing consciously that you're having symptoms. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And, you know, that invisible injury, there are no crutches or anything, any visible signs of that injury. And I'll tell you a big part of that, too, that pressure was peer pressure because nobody could see the injury. And that pushed me to do things beyond what I should have been. But I had this desire that, oh, it's a burning desire at all costs. And nobody was there telling me what the end result could be. At the gym, I asked one of the old timers for advice. You know, I said, geez, I've been having these headaches and I feel tired. And one of the old timers jumped up and he said, son, headaches are a part of this game. I could remember these words forever. And he says, you have all the ability to get to the top. Now, either gut it up or this game's not for you. Well, when somebody tells you that, and you're going to gut it up because you think that headaches are a part of the game. Don't worry about it. They'll go away when you retire. But they were not telling me anything intentionally bad, they themselves didn't know any better. So
right.
It's just a matter of lack of education, complete education. And that's
well, in the medical profession didn't know. The athletes didn't know. The coaches didn't know. The doctors didn't know. Nobody really knew what kind of damage was being done in the short term or what it could turn into in the long term back when you were going through this experience. So,
well, you know, Kim, before, I'd like to talk about Mint Sr. in a little bit, I'm sure, because you asked me, I think you asked me about him. But there's one thing I'd like to clear up about second impact syndrome or second impact injury. And it always carries with it a high risk of permanent brain damage. But in exceptional cases, it can be fatal among adolescents. And this is where in my time, like that age, the adolescent brain is not fully myelinated. This means that their nerve cells do not have the insulation like an adult brain. So it leaves them far more vulnerable for a serious injury. So that's why it's so important that we really, really watch these adolescent kids with these sports.
Absolutely. The brain doesn't fully develop until a kid's 25. And so, you know, you talk about the age that you started sports and, you know, like in football, Pop Warner, you know, these kids are all so young. Their brains are not developed yet. And when they're sustaining brain damage, 13, 14, 15 years old, and then, you know, in school, well, you said, you know, it's your story played out across America, across the world, that people don't recognize those injuries, and maybe somebody starts being slow at school or having behavioral problems, missing school, and you think that it's strictly behavior or that the kid is a bad seed, as we would say. And a lot of times those are undiagnosed brain injuries that the kid has had. One, it can be one, you know, if it's the right one, or a culmination of more than one brain injury. And that's the causal factor of brain damage, that goes undiagnosed. And then, you know, the kid starts having cognitive problems, emotional problems, a lot of other problems, and nobody can figure out where it came from. And that's one of the reasons why you're out talking and why I'm having you talk about it, because these are preventable now if people know about it. You know, I was talking about, and we'll go back to the Monsignor, but back whatever year the movie Concussion came out, that up, I was on the air when that movie came out, and my husband and I went and saw it. And, you know, as recent as that was, and it had to be in the last decade, you know, I was so moved by that show. I was talking about, and this was before I met Dr. Amalu, and I had to laugh because one thing I'll tell you about Ray's book is that not only is it a really compelling story, but the last third or so of the book are different articles, copies of his awards, some amazing pictures, and a picture of he and Dr. Amalu together, and that's who Will Smith played in the movie. And I laughed because I told you in the intro that when Ray and I met on the phone, we had so many things in common that we talked about and had such a fun conversation, I think for a couple hours, that when I got to the back of the book, I just started laughing because there was a picture of him and Dr. Amalu together about a year difference, and I surprised him and emailed him a picture of me and Dr. Amalu standing together. But when that movie came out, I remember coming on the air and talking about it and having some guests come on and talk about concussion. And I had some pretty strong feelings about it. I don't hold back. And boy, you know, there were people out there sending me poison pen letters and throwing tomatoes, and they just did not want to believe that that was true. Any science to back that up? It's only in the movies, blah, 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 blah. You know, they're all going through that. Now, that has changed since that year where, you know, I was putting up with a lot of grief from the public that didn't want to believe it. You know, they didn't want to believe it. But then enough science started building up. And when it happened to their own kid or someone they knew or an athlete, which you hear about all the time, then things started clicking in people's minds and it made sense. And then the science became the truth that nobody knew before. Now, there's still a lot of people that are going to go ahead and be risk takers and get into all of these things. But the difference is, back then, with you, like you say, the coaches, nobody knew. And, you know, with football, the NFL had known and lied, held back the documents for decades. There's still players willing to go and willing to do these things. But one big difference is they can't say they didn't know now the risk they were taking. You know, they weren't blindsided like back when you were boxing. And in the not so long ago, you know, in football, they got into all those lawsuits and everything. And, you know, anybody who's stepping out on the field now should know, you know, exactly what the possibilities are, you know, when they make that decision to play. So, and that's one of the things that you say. In fact, let me see. I might not be able to find it. We might be going straight to the Monsignor, but this was from a speech. I dog-eared one of the pages here. And basically, you were telling the kids not to lie, and we can get to that when we talk about the legislation you helped get passed in New York. But you say, for those young people here today who have already sustained a concussion with continued symptoms, keep on punching toward recovery, but leave no doubt and wait it out before returning to competition. For the rest of you here today, my story begins one evening in my grandfather's Italian restaurant when I was 6 years old. So you tell people, you warn them about waiting it out, but another place in the book, you talk about not lying. And, you know, earlier when you talked about those fights and you tried to lie out of it, one of the problems, and I'm getting a little ahead of ourselves, but with the safety protocols, you know, that I've taken note of, and I think it's important for, you know, both of us to address, is that even with the safety protocols, we have to really talk about the the impact of what can happen, and we're going to in this interview. But a lot of things are very self-policing these days. A kid wants to play, and so they don't tell the truth all the time, deny that they're having headaches, deny that they're having brain fog, you know, a hard time focusing. They don't tell the truth when asked questions by the coach. And sometimes the coaches, you know, they want a winning team, so they overlook some things, and they're supposed to see the team doctor and get the nod from the doctor before they go back out on the field. But the doctor's often paid by the league or the team. And so, you know, that's self-policing and calls for some honesty, you know, for everyone to be honest and put their other agendas and wants and desires aside for the bigger cause and what can happen. And that goes for the peer pressure as well. You know, the teammates saying, ah, come on, you wuss, oh, come on, you just got your bell rung. And all of that, you've got your teammates, you've got coach. But it's very important for everyone to be honest, because if you really do want to play again, which, I don't know, me seeing interviewing so many people and seeing what can happen, there's certain sports I wouldn't let my kid play in if I had them. But honesty is really important, and not thinking you're getting one by not telling the truth to be able to play that next game that'll get you into the playoffs, or whatever the reason for not telling the truth might be. For any one of those three parties, the player, the coach, or the team physician, because it just isn't worth a lifetime for that one game.
Yes, it's so true. You know, the expression, the phrase I made up, the game you sit out today could be the career you save tomorrow. You know, for the sake of one fight, I threw a whole career away. What a huge mistake. Huge. And a lot of these things you've covered, you know, Kim, I've had 50 years to ponder what went wrong. And I always come back to the same conclusion. Lack of concussion education and peer pressure led to my demise. Because of that invisible injury, and I had to fight that invisible opponent. I had to fight two opponents in the ring, the opponent and the invisible one, because I had to carry these extremely bad headaches, and they would get worse with exertion. So now what I was doing was actually carrying opponents, because I was laying back. Because the more I exerted, the worse the headache got. So
right.
People were seeing that this change in my style, change in aggression, because I was very aggressive before, and then I had to start hearing the remarks like he's lost the eye of the tiger, and some even had the audacity to question if my heart was still in the game. This is the same boxer that won the Golden Glove Heart Award. Now he was having his heart questioned. So this peer pressure, never underestimate its power and influence. And that was one of the big reasons for me gutting everything out. And geez, I hope I haven't gotten ahead of myself here.
That's okay. We'll back up. We were going to talk about the Monsignors, where I led you astray and inserted just a little more information about second impact syndrome, because it is important. If you don't give things time to heal, and I'm going to do it to you again, but I'm going to remember the Monsignor, is that, as you know, and we'll go ahead and say, you know, you really got to be careful about the making sure it's well, because concussions don't show up on imaging. And so one of the things you really need to be mindful about, and because those of us who've had a concussion aren't thinking clearly and aren't recognizing something is off, often it's a loved one around us who notices that we're forgetting or that we seem to be going and taking more aspirin or, you know, Tylenol or whatever we're going to take, you know, that we're not normally a person who's taken a lot of Tylenol, and a loved one sees us go to the cabinet every other day. Geez, I got a headache. And we're not even knowing that that's, it's not even registering with us that that's abnormal, that people don't have headaches every other day, you know, that they're going to the medicine cabinet to get Tylenol for. So since it doesn't show up on imaging and we're not always in our right mind, it's helpful if someone around us is paying attention, especially if you're in boxing or you're in some other contact sport. If you know someone who's fallen, you know, falling is the number one, 46% of the traumatic brain injuries are caused by falls. If a person's gotten in an accident, you know, but it appears that they're okay. I think I told you about walking out on my back deck in 2015, and I don't know what happened. I don't know if I tripped on the threshold where the screen door was or a flip-flop or what happened, but I went flying through the air and landed. I had my arms locked straight out in front of me, and I landed forward really hard on my palms, and then my neck snapped back as my body went back with my leg underneath me. And because of my first brain incident in 1995, all I could think of as I was falling was, God, don't let me hit my head. Well, I didn't hit my head. And so, you know, you do the inventory. Well, nothing broken, nothing bleeding. Whew, I didn't hit my head. Cool. And then, you know, kind of go about your business. But, you know, come to find out then, I was having problems with headaches and didn't even realize it. And at that time, what disappointed me, you know, back in 95, nobody really knew anything about the after effects of brain aneurysm or ABIs, things that originate inside the brain, which is now categorized under TBI at the Brain Injury Association. But, you know, I didn't know. And when I had that whiplash concussion is what it wound up being when I went to the emergency room and talked to them about what had happened and the headaches I was having and the memory issues, it was them that informed me that it couldn't be shown on a scan. But when I told them what happened, and you talk about this part in your book, a lot of people have the wrong impression that to have a concussion, you had to be knocked out or that you had to be physically touched. Well, there is such a thing as a whiplash concussion. And I think that's probably what happened to that comedian recently, Bob Saget, who apparently fell in his hotel room and hit the back of his head, and the G-force of hitting the back of his head and his head snapping forward caused his brain to have that, they call it a coup contra coup motion, where the brain slaps the back of the skull and bounces forward to hit the front of the skull. So there's actually a double impact that goes on. And a lot of times you'll see that out on the football field when they grab somebody's jersey and they're not necessarily hit and knocked down, but their heads snap, you know, their neck snaps, their head back and forth. Mm-hmm. And you hear of whiplash and car accidents, but that same motion can happen in falls or anything else. And so, again, it's hard to tell when a concussion is healed. You know, it's one thing to say with you don't want to get second impact. That leads to lifelong issues and possibly into degenerative brain diseases later, which we'll talk about. But it's a hard thing to tell when a concussion is resolved on imaging. And so, again, that's when it's really important. And your wife, Patty, you know, has also really been an angel in your life because she married you when you already had your injury. You know, a lot of the people that I talked to were married for quite some time and then they had their injury. Patty was around. You had already gotten your injury when you guys started dating and got married. And it's important that loved ones watch for out of character behavior when any of these things has happened, because it might be a telltale sign that that concussion isn't healed yet, if you're still having symptoms. So there's a little more explanation into the second impact.
Yeah, but the only real judge is yourself. And when you'll know when you're totally healed. If you try to fool them, you're rolling the dice where the wager far exceeds the prize. And so you have to be honesty. It'll always be the best policy, and it'll always be the best protection against brain injury. Honesty. I can't beat that any more than I do. If you're just honest about these things, go get the help. The help is there. And it's really not all this, these studies and all these phrases and things, but it's a very simple thing. Very simple. And if you do this, you'll always be all right. And it's, if you get your bell rung, have it promptly reported and taken care of totally. And you're good to go. It's not rocket science. But this is what we have to drum here probably forever, because somebody's always going to want to skirt the issue, not knowing the repercussions.
Well, and speaking of that, let's get back to your story for a minute. Before we go to the Monsignor, or if I'm remembering the time span incorrectly, I wanted to talk a little bit about, again, people will read the particulars in your book. And again, I would encourage you to look at the website, The Second Impact. It will show you how to get to Amazon to buy Ray's book. And it's Ray wasn't in this for the money. He was in it for the message, but you have to pay your expenses. It's about $10. So certainly affordable for a powerful message. And excuse me, the amazing pictures in the back of the book and information and scans and all kinds of things. But you, what happened when, because you were in New York boxing, what happened, because this will lead to legislation. Now, in sequence, you either tell me about the Monsignor, if that comes first, or you tell me about the Hoppin States to box, so you could keep boxing. What happened in New York that made you unable, and how you skirted the rules to do what you did. Which one of those came first, the chicken or the egg, the Monsignor or the state skipping?
You know, the Monsignor became a mentor to me, and he saw the change. And I always confided, I was honest with him. And he strong-armed me, and I didn't want to go. But he made an appointment for me to get tested. And the doctor recommended I see a neurologist. And she did what was called an electrocephalogram, an EEG brainwave test. Well, that test came back abnormal. And, geez, she was very surprised at the abnormality of it. So I left the office that day. Okay, I have an abnormal test, and I'm going to go on. But she turned around and wrote a letter to the boxing commission stating that I couldn't be doing. She was ahead of her time, and she felt that I could, you know, get some more serious injury here. So next thing I know, I'm sitting in Monsignor's office, and the mailman came, and there was a letter for me. And it stated I was suspended by the New York State Boxing Commission for the abnormal EEG. Well, you know, here we go, Kim. Some athletes have to be protected from themselves. And my relentless determination and desire defied all common sense and logic, and even at that time, some advice. So the reapplication process required a one-year layoff, and then you had to come back and repeat the electrocephalogram, and then you had to go before the New York State Boxing Commission's advisory board in order to get reinstated. Well, again, here I go. After confiding with some of the veteran boxers, I learned this could be a long process with no guarantees, because New York was the toughest state for regulations in the country. So I left New York, and I used different aliases to fight in states that had less regulation or no regulation at all. But you have to understand, unlike the NFL, professional boxing was not governed by one national commission. Each state governed their own and supervised boxing with their own rules and regulations, and they didn't have any access to anything to enforce out-of-state suspensions. So there I was, changing my name every time out, and I got involved with a ring of promoters that, you know, kept me real busy and sharp. And I thought that I could circumvent this by hiding from the commission and staying sharp, and they wouldn't think they would think I took the rest. Well, in 1972, I returned to New York for a repeat electrocephalogram, and that again produced abnormal results, nullifying my reapplication for New York State license. And the neurologist, in her report, she just said it was grossly abnormal and consistent with cortical dysfunction and left posterior great amount of abnormality. But I didn't understand what this was, and again, nobody told me that this would last forever. So I defiantly circumvented a New York policy that was put into place to protect me. You know, looking back now, a federal law or a national boxing commission would have protected me from myself. But I continued to fight and run the unregulated states until 1974. I took a break because I just couldn't take the headaches anymore. And I expected these symptoms would go away with rest, but they didn't go away. I realized then I wasn't going to be the middleweight champion. I reluctantly hung up the gloves and threw every bit of my memorabilia out, just threw it all out. And it was shortly after that I was having these cognitive issues. And again, Monsignor suggested I get an evaluation at a mental health clinic. And so I went to the Clifton Springs Mental Health Clinic, where I remained 10 days, Kim, at the clinic before leaving against medical advice. I was diagnosed with severe depression, but I was living in denial, and I didn't want to accept that answer. I refused to take the medication or suggested counseling. And, you know, from there I went into seclusion. I traveled the country where I didn't have to see anybody, and I went to all the national parks where I kind of took refuge. But, you know, after several months, the old expression, you can run, but you can't hide, became a reality. And I came out battling because that's what I do. And, you know, I never gave up ever in my life. And that was my attitude. And I relied on that relentless attitude to get me through the toughest of rounds. And now I was relying on that same attitude to answer the toughest fight of my life. Well, you know, attitude, Kim, is the only thing that we have total control of. That's the only thing we have total control of. And Charles Swindoll said it best. He said, life is 10% what happens to us and 90% how we deal with it. So, and that's when I went on to try to go to college to be a physical education teacher, but I failed right away because of concentration problems. Monsignor got me a job at Eastman Kodak in Rochester, and I was doing fine for a while, but then the hand tremors got worse, and I kept more forgetfulness. And finally, in 1994, I think, they sent me to the University of Rochester, who had a neuroscience research center. And through all a lot of testing, they diagnosed me with dementia pugilistica and Parkinson's syndrome, all the direct result of untreated concussions. I repeat, untreated concussions. So I retired at the very young age of 44. But that didn't end there, because I tried calling the NCAA and the NFL, and they kind of threw me aside and said, we have everything under control. And that's when I took it upon myself to make the website and start lecturing. But the real thing happened in 1994. I got a call from the office of John McCain, and they got my name. And we had a tough time because I didn't want to testify about the corruption in boxing. And they wanted me to give names. I wouldn't give names and venues. We finally came to the agreement that I would give them procedure, but I would not give them names and venue. So in turn, they gave me complete anonymity. They gave me no prosecution. And they passed what was called, in 1996, because of some of my input, a lot of my input, the 1996 Professional Boxing Safety Act. And one of the big things this did was it put an end to the dangerous, underhanded practice of state hopping. And that law prohibited fighters from fighting anywhere in the United States while you were under suspension. And they also made fingerprinting on cards, and they were computerized, on which we didn't have in our day. But there was one punishment that I did get. And it was made that anybody that fought on these unsanctioned cards their record would be wiped clean so that they couldn't get any credit for it. And this would help to keep somebody else from trying to do it because there'd be no future in it. But, you know, I was okay with that because I really didn't want kids to see you be rewarded for cheating. Because that's basically what it was. And so I guess good came out of it in the respect that there was a law to keep somebody else from getting hurt.
I understand the questions they asked you. You know, you'd feel like on one hand you were squealing and, you know, we all know what the deal is about that. But, you know, the point is you saved lives, not only people from cheating, but you saved lives from doing the right thing. And, you know, sometimes it's the greater good and not worrying about what others might think about it, because you know the people that got a problem with it that tell you about it, you know, you hear those people. What you might not hear as much is the people whose lives you've saved because they were unable to do the same thing that you did, to go down that path, you know. And
well, Kim, your book is very similar. It's a very touching book. You've been through a lot. But I liken both of us and what we do to a seatbelt. A seatbelt will never let you know about the lives it saves because it saves them. The only time you hear about the severity is when somebody doesn't wear it. So I think we saved a lot of people some harm and just don't know about it, but I get deep in our hearts. We don't have to really know, but we know that we've done something to give back and to help somebody else. And I can't explain it any more than that. But,
well, it's also that we're not terminally unique. You know, anything we've done, a lot of other people have done too.
Sure.
You know, we might not know who they are, but we're not terminally unique. You know, there's people out, a lot of people out there, we just don't know their names, but, you know, they've done the same things, you know, done the same things. So, well, that was a great act of advocacy that you did as you were turning things around. And you know, your story echoes what the process is for a lot of people listening tonight, and including me. You know, that you're going about your life and something changes and you can't go back to doing what you were doing, and you know, you're in what I call the tweener stage, where you can't go back, but forward looks like a dark hole and you don't have any idea what that's going to be. And that was a good idea, going around to all the parks and taking in the nature. Nature is so cathartic, you know, to go out and do that. You know, I don't look at it so much as an escape maybe from the mental and physical anguish you were having, and a chance to go out and let nature heal you back to pointing you in a direction of the keep on punching, which doesn't mean literally as much as you say, keep on punching through recovery. And so that set you on a course of advocacy. And that was one of the first things. Now, one of the things that we had in common that I wanted to mention, the Monsignor was from Boys Town, right?
Yes. Yes, he ran a home for troubled and boys that were let out of a detention center and had no home to go to or were disowned, and it was a large home. I think 100 boys had room for it, and it was called Buffalo Boys Town, and it was a takeoff from the home you have in Nebraska. I think Father Flanagan was it, or
Father Flanagan. In fact, it's kind of an anniversary of sorts because tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day. Father Flanagan came from Ireland, and he started Boys Town here. The original Boys Town is here. And one of the coincidences we were talking about in our first conversation is my mom's side of the family is Italian, and so I had an Italian grandpa, and we had a very special relationship like you had with yours. And then you were telling me about the Monsignor in Boys Town, and I was telling you that my grandfather, who was orphaned, actually, his parents shortly after, not so long after they came to this country from Italy, his dad was hit by a drunk driver, and his mom, funny, were at this point of this pandemic because she died in February of practically this time in 1920 of the great influenza, the first one, the Spanish flu. And so he was orphaned, and he spent a number of years at Boys Town. And I sent you a picture. Father Flanagan made all the boys, everybody had to play an instrument, and everybody had to play sports. And they were ahead of their time in that their community has their own police department, their own post office service, their own zip code. And back when he was growing up, our city was small enough that it was way, way, way out in the country where Boys Town was. And now I shared with you, the city has grown west, just quadrupled since I was a kid. The city's huge now compared to when I was a kid, and we live just a couple miles from the original Boys Town. And so, again, when we were talking and you were telling me a little bit about your story, Boys Town did open some satellite operations around the country, and I became aware through you that there was one in New York, but I spend a lot of time at Boys Town taking pictures. They've got some beautiful gardens there, and when you talk about, well, I talked about nature being very healing, and I'm happy to have spring coming around the corner. A lot of neat gardens and Hall of History there that talks all about the history of Boys Town and a lot of the kids who grew up there, who went on to have celebrity status, whether it was in sports or acting or in the military, decorated soldiers in the military. And their Oscar from the movie Boys Town is there, and an Emmy Award that they got for a TV documentary is there. And so I thought that was interesting. That was one of the things Ray and I talked about in the beginning. We were just visiting, and different things came up that we were ping-ponging back and forth and that we had in common, you know, these relationships with our grandfather and the connection with Boys Town and the boxing. Of course, my grandpa only did it there because he had to, you know, while he was a resident. But that's when you shared with me that you went and did boxing with those kids, helped those kids, and inspired them at your Boys Town there, and that the Monsignor who was your mentor came from Boys Town. But with St. Patrick's Day being tomorrow, Father Flanagan come from Ireland and start Boys Town. So, interesting.
That's, yeah,
he would have been celebrating tomorrow.
Yes, and that home was responsible for turning so many lives around. And Monsignor had a real rapport, because he was a tough, tough guy. And there was many an occasion where he took that collar off. If somebody got out of line, then they went into the gym, put the gloves on. They didn't last too long with him. And then he earned that respect. And he had such an effect on me because he was so rough with me, because I had that hard head. And just one quick one here. He was sitting in the front row at one of my fights in Montreal. And that day I had this opponent, and that night I had this opponent in trouble, and the corner was yelling to me, "Go downstairs, you know, go downstairs." I kept headhunting, and the opponent was getting away from me because he was pretty slick. So between rounds, the Monsignor stuck his head up in between the ring apron and the first rope. He stuck his head up there, and he said, "Ray, you know something, son? You have the heart of a lion and the head of a jackass." And he went back down and sat down. You know, I mean, it was those things that kind of, you know, get to you. But he knew how to do it. He knew how to do it with everybody. And, of course, when I got back, I had to get all the jokes about, you know, that I pinned the donkey and whatever. But it lasted. You know, Kim, he passed away, and that was one of the hardest things in my life. But before he passed away, he had to wear for all to save some of that memorabilia I threw out, and he mailed it back to Patty, and he was leaving. And
no kidding.
Yeah, but there's another. I'll go back to him, but there's another gentleman here that has been a real inspiration to me after the Monsignor left. And that's Andy Siegel, the personal injury lawyer. And I mean, he's from New York. He's so dedicated to representing, you know, the survivors of brain injury. And he authored my book, and the author to serve as a deterrent to anyone who might consider circumventing the proper concussion protocol. And, you know, I will be forever grateful, you know, for his support, his encouragement, and his friendship, for which I'll always hold in the highest regard. I just can't say enough about him. He just helps me out a lot. Of course, well, with my wife, Patty, that is. So I had to throw that in there. Yes, that the Boys Towns, it's now closed because Monsignor got ill and he couldn't put on the boxing shows anymore, because it was the boxing shows that carried the facility, the expenses. So they had to close its doors. I wish I had enough revenue to reopen it. I would. Be some big shoes to fill, though. I don't know if I could do that.
Everything in its time, but I'm glad, because I read in your book that you threw away your things when you got the bad news, and I remember thinking when I read it that you might feel differently down the road, and that it was, I can understand why you did it, but I'm happy to hear that. If you put that in your book, I missed it, because I do remember you saying you got rid of all of your memorabilia and that when you got the news that you were going to have to stop, but I didn't know that that he recovered some of that and sent it to Patty, and I think that's important. You know, it's important. This has been a terrible ordeal, but, you know, God makes messengers in different ways, and when you started, it was really something that you wanted to do, and it wasn't your fault that that knowledge wasn't out there. It's a shame that it wasn't. Now it is, and we're telling people. A couple questions I'd like to ask you when we talk about your diagnosis. So when they gave you the diagnosis of, and I'm going to call it CTE for a moment because that's what people are just, you know, they found out about CTE from the movie Concussion.
Right.
And so I think more people have heard the term CTE, even if they don't know what it stands for, than dementia pugilistica. So those, correct me if I'm wrong, are interchangeable terms.
Yes.
And the question I had for you is that back when I was talking about after the movie, when I was getting poison pen letters for talking about the effects of repeated concussions, you weren't able to get a diagnosis of CTE until a post-mortem special kind of autopsy of the brain. It doesn't just happen in a routine autopsy. The brain actually has to have a special type of autopsy to be able to determine that a cause of death was CTE back then, around the time of the movie Concussion. And when you told me about your diagnosis, the Parkinson's syndrome and the CTE, I wondered how you knew, since you're obviously still here, and I thought we'd talk for just a minute for people how now they're diagnosing CTE ahead of time, and of course they can't confirm it until after the fact, but they're obviously giving the diagnosis, and they weren't doing that before, so I guess I'm not really aware of when they started giving that diagnosis, but what were some of the symptoms or the differences in symptoms, I guess, that give you the two diagnoses, Parkinson's syndrome and CTE, and we can take them one at a time if you want, but just to let people know some of the symptoms that you've experienced, something they might be looking for. You know, there's a lot of athletes and others out there who have symptoms and they don't have a diagnosis. So they're going through what you were talking about. They're having cognitive problems. They're having broken relationships from lack of impulse control, behavioral changes. In fact, I'll let you talk about some of those, but some in brain injury in general are short. Excuse me, I've kind of kept a list over the years, and not all of us have all of these, but we all have some of these. Short-term memory loss, trouble focusing our attention, that's that brain fog we talk about. Narrow fatigue, which is running out of energy, and I call those, it's not original, I heard it from another guest at one time, but brain bugs. You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, don't cut people a lot of slack that say they're too tired to go and do something, because I get tired too, you know, that sort of thing. But for somebody with a brain injury, the way that I liken it, the way that it works for me, you can tell me how it works for you, is, you know, we have a certain amount of brain bucks each day to work with.
Right.
And for me, focusing on a project, I used to be able to juggle five balls in the air, you know, five different activities in the air and do them with precision and without mistakes and with relative ease. And after the fact, I tried to do that because that was my default, you know, was multitasking. And I found out that, you know, when I do that, it gets me really frustrated and either angry or depressed because I start making mistakes or forgetting or getting a headache or my symptoms get worse. I really need to focus on one thing at a time or some of the other things go to hell in a handbasket. So that neurofatigue in my brain bucks, you know, I work on the computer during the day and I book these shows and I talk to guests and I do what I do during the daytime. And about 4 o'clock my time, which is Snickers time for a lot of the world, the end of the afternoon is nap time for me. You know, I made a joke earlier with you. You know, you sent me a note looking forward to the show, and I said, go take a nap. That's what I'm going to do. I find that my brain bucks are spent 4 o'clock, or if you want to look at it like the battery on your phone, you know, most people wake up with a full battery, and it lasts them the whole day. People with brain injury, as a rule, wake up with maybe three-quarters of a battery to start the day, and the battery's drained by late afternoon, and I have to lay down for a little while to recharge my battery so I can go the rest of the evening without making mistakes or falling asleep in my husband's face while we're watching a movie or, you know, whatever it is, you know, there's that need to be able to recharge. So it's not just a matter of being tired. It's I absolutely cannot go any further until I decompress and recharge. Dizziness and balance issues, cognitive deficits we were talking about. Sometimes that's processing things slower than we did before, or not having the same level of comprehension. Aphasia, which is trouble recalling or understanding words, and we talked about that, you know, trying to find the right word. We know the word, and we're saying the sentence, and damn it, where'd that that blank spot, you know, and you trying to pull down that word, you know, and it just doesn't come. And then, you know, a half hour later, you're doing something completely different, eating a banana or something, and the other person's gone and that word comes back, you know, to your head. Yeah, right, that's it. Not being able to handle overstimulation, bright lights, people, noises. I have a really hard time with multiple conversations going on around me. If I'm trying to talk to someone and there's a lot of other people talking around me or having other conversations around me, I find it hard to focus on what I was saying to the person that I'm talking to. Anxiety about the slightest things, depression. Many people with brain injury have chronic pain issues, and an 11th would be sleep issues. A lot of people have sleep issues, and these are just common to any TBI, the ones that I just read. But going back over now to your diagnoses, it's probably going to include some of those things, but how did you come to get your CTE diagnosis? When did, if you don't know when they started being able to give that diagnosis while a person was still alive, What symptoms merit that diagnosis?
Well, the first thing is the CTE did not exist back when they were evaluating me. And what they had was old-time fighters that were mumbling and slow with their mentation. And this is what they were basing things on. They didn't have MRIs back then. But what they did have was the CT scans. And they had one that would do a whole bunch of slices, as they would call them, very high in radiation, very intense. But they could really look into the brain for even the microscopic damage. When the report came back, they didn't need anything microscopic. The brain scar tissue that was in my head, my brain, was that of a 90-year-old man. So there was no question. They didn't call it CTE, but they knew I had dementia because of my slow mentation, the gait in my walk, the tremors in my hands. And this pretty much told them the story of what they've kind of witnessed through the years. And the best way they explained it to me was this. They said what I had was like somebody digging around a tree. And what they did was they dug most of the roots except for the main root. Well, in time, the roots that they dug and killed cut off the oxygen and the water to some of the other veins, which in turn, they would die within time. So this explained the progression. And it's not a fast progression. It's a slow progression, but it is progressive. And that's how they explain it to me, that the roots are going to continue to die off. And, you know, there's three D's to the dementia. The first one is denial. Most people deny. The next one, they get depressed over it. But when they wait a little bit longer, that comes to the dysfunction and these other issues. So, I was lucky to have some very good things, Kim. And one of them, I was blessed with a wife that's been with me 48 years, 42 years of marriage. And she's one tough cookie. And it takes that. And she pulled me through the toughest of stuff. And she watches me like an eagle, but it's needed. And it's just, you gotta have to, the success I found is that I don't drink, I don't smoke. I try to, keep myself healthy. But most of all, I listen to my caregivers, because sometimes you don't want to, but you have to do that. That's the key to the whole thing. And then I found this, giving back and keeping my head oiled. It doesn't mean that I'm going to escape this, but I'm going to delay it a little bit. And that's what I found to be. And, living with it is, there's a lot of guilt here, a lot of guilt. I try to help the children with autism and all the kids with TBI because, I was born with a perfectly healthy brain. I destroyed myself. And these children were dealt a hard speed bump in life, right from birth, through no fault of their own. So that guilt, and the other guilt is, I have these good days and bad days and medium days, and the only thing I can explain to it is, and I hate to use the word drunk, but it is. It's like consuming alcohol. You can have a drink, maybe two drinks, and you feel a buzz. Well, that's what you have every day, and that's considered a good day. But now you have a day where you might have had 4 or 5 drinks. Now you're kind of iffy, but you're still coherent, but you're slurring and whatever. But now that day you're totally drunk, you know, you can't leave Patty or keep me in the house. And I feel so guilty because she can't go where she wants to go, where we're invited on stuff like that. And either she goes alone or she doesn't go at all. And I struggle with that guilt. And it's part of the paranoia. We go out. And I'll sit on my hands sometimes to hide them from shaking, but you know, I don't do that anymore. But the other thing is we'll come home and I'll be unsure of myself because of, like you expressed, the double or triple conversations going on. I can't comprehend it, and I try to fool my way through it, fool everybody.
Yeah.
But when I get home, I'll say, honey, was I all right tonight? Did I act all right? Did I say anything out of line? And because I can't remember. And she'll usually say, yes, honey, you were fine. And things like we'll be going to a wedding. And then I'll have a suit on and I'll say, honey, where are we going? She'll have to tell me. I mean, these are all things you can't fool. And, you know, the Aberdeen Proving Grounds is, you see a lot of these professional athletes claiming they can't think, they can't remember their kids, and I feel bad for that. But, you know, when they drive off in their SUV with their family in the car, I don't know. I had my driving privileges restricted, and thank God they did. Because you can't drive with that memory lapse. You see a red light and you forget it's there. Now you're jeopardizing yourself, everybody else. And, you know, after 4 or 5 accidents, they finally pulled it. And thank God they did. So, you know, there's so much to this. I can't take my granddaughters on hikes unsupervised because of mental lapses. You know, they get away from you for 1 second, and they could get hit by a car because you're in that little fog for a few seconds. So there's so much to this, Kim. I just want to help somebody else so they don't have to go through this. It's a terrible thing to have to go through because it is so avoidable. So avoidable.
I appreciate that. We're down to 10 minutes. I feel bad about you feeling guilty about something you can't help. Certainly don't have the same experience that you have. But it is hard enough every day to live with the deficits without feeling guilt, which is really guilt and worry are both wasted emotions that drain a lot of energy because there isn't a damn thing you can do about it.
No.
And, you know, you're here with purpose and you're saving lives. And you're sharing very personal parts of yourself that a lot of people keep a secret, and they do that hiding that you're talking about. And I get that. I do. But I also get that you're coming out and you're talking about it, and people can relate to what you're saying. And you're helping them, because if they think they're the only ones, they know they're not now. And if they're somebody who's had a concussion, who's fudging, they know that it can lead to some pretty serious consequences that are far-reaching, that can affect your entire life, and it isn't worth it for that one match or that one game. And, you know, Patty chose you. She didn't know everything she was going to be in for, but she chose you after you had your brain injury. I was surprised when I started reading the book that you already had had concussions when you guys got married. One thing with the 9 minutes, I want to say real quick, going back to your symptoms you were talking about, I read this. I don't know if you know this, but dementia pugilistica, or punch drunk syndrome, is a form of acquired cognitive impairment that occurs in up to a fifth of professional boxers. It also includes other sports in which there may be mild trauma, such as football, mixed martial arts, soccer, and a list of other things here. So, you know, a fifth of the people, and that's just the ones that have been diagnosed. So this is a lot more common than we think. We didn't even, as we mentioned in the beginning, know that concussion was really a serious thing, a potentially very serious thing that can lead to post-concussion syndrome, which can be lifetime symptoms and then can morph into degenerative brain diseases like you've discussed. And, you know, at least your grandkids get to know their grandpa. You know, on my side, I had a very close relationship with one grandpa, and there was one I never met. You know, and the one that I met impacted my life still, always. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the other one that I didn't meet, I got no idea. You know, I never met him. He was a stranger to me. And Patty got the guy she picked. And, you know, relationships aren't easy. I really sucked at them for a long time. You know, my parents have been married, it'll be 64 years this year. You guys have been married in the 40s. I'll be lucky to live long enough to be married 25 years. I didn't get married till I was 45. And so, you know, the time that you've had together, the good times, you know, the good times, I would try to focus on those, because obviously those other times are there. You can't ignore them. You can't deny them. They're hard to deal with for both of you. But it is what it is. And there were times, other times, on those good days and those good times that are snapshot happy memories that you have to put in a mental photo album, I guess, or maybe a real photo album, and try to focus on those. I just, I don't devalue your feelings. Your feelings are what your feelings are. It's just sad to have to feel guilty about something you can't help. You know, you didn't know back then. You weren't a bad boy. You know, you were living in a time where they didn't, everybody breaks rules too, okay? So everybody, when they're a kid, breaks rules. And you had no idea what the consequences were going to be. And you're paying. And to me, you know, that you got enough to worry about without feeling guilty. You got the consequences.
But, you know, Kim, there's one thing that I don't want to separate myself, because that's not what I'm trying to do, but I'd like to explain that when you're out there a lot, and there's always people that are trying to discredit you or things of that nature, give you a hard time, because these are people that don't want to listen to your story or your findings. I'll have a talk, and I'll have it 3 months in advance. But yet when I get there, somehow the football team had a scrimmage that day. You know, isn't that coincidental? I'll have coaches not want to meet with me. They just don't want to hear this stuff. And even publicly, you get these snide remarks because they all expect to see you. You see you out on a good day. They don't see you on a bad day. So when they see you on a good day, they say, gee, there's nothing wrong with him. You know, they expect to see you in a wheelchair. So these are tough things that you, and the more you're out there, the more they come after you. And it's not a whole big percent. It's like a bunch of gnats. It only takes a few percent to really, you know, kind of shake things up a little bit. It gives you something else to battle. Because I don't have any quitting me. Bring them on. Do you have to have that? No. Just, I hope I came across right with that. And as far as Patty,
you absolutely did. Mm-hmm. You absolutely did. And I'll let you go ahead and say, and as far for Pat is about Patty, but you know, with the others and those scrimmages and those talks and so forth, you realize those people really don't want to hear what you have to say because it's the truth, and it might discourage their players from wanting to take those risks. You know, Chris Bolin, I think, he was a football player, a nice young man. I think that was his name, although my memory stinks. But he was a guy that was a great football player and had a chance to have all the celebrity, all the money, all the stuff, that trappings that come with it. He found out after the movie Concussion and CTE, and he said, nah, I want to have a family. I want to have a career. There's things I want to do in life, and this ain't worth it. And to have somebody like you come out and be a speaker, there are going to be some people, and it's not about you. It's about them and their agenda. They don't care about their players and those souls' futures. They care about here and now and the money that they're going to make and the celebrity they're going to make. And that's why they don't want you there. It really has nothing to do with you. So, you know, that's one thing maybe to not take it so personally. It is rude when people set an appointment and stand you up, you know, and I'd give them a few words about that. But as far as your speech,
I try to take everything on the chin because I believe I can take it. And I have through a lot of the peer pressure, okay? I've dealt with that. I've dealt with reporters. You know, I've had one coach say, it's pretty good. I got to take advice from a punch-drunk palooka. Now, here's a guy that hasn't accomplished anything in his life outside of some, you know, backyard football, and he's calling me a punch-drunk palooka. Okay, but you have to consider that. You're going to get it. Or he's a boxer. What did he expect? You know, oh, I see. You see, Kim, boxers are the low end considered. Nobody cared about us being punch drunk years ago. But as soon as the high end, the NFL, started getting things, now we're doing research and paying attention. They don't want to hear anything from the boxers, but they could learn a lot from us. And that's for another day. But, there's no give up in me, and there's some obstacles. But I think sometimes it works in reverse because it just fires me up even more. But I just don't know
the
reason.
Good thing.
Yeah, I don't know why it has to happen, but I guess it's again, you're right, agendas with some people. Yeah,
well,
my guiding
it is.
Light. Yeah,
it is.
My wife.
Well, and what, and Patty, I was going to say, and you were going to say something about Patty.
Well, you just, without her, none of this would have been possible, because you can't imagine how much she's had to, you know, look after me, but she's done it, never complained, and put up with about 48 years, 42 of marriage, never complained, never woe is me, always looking, checking my medicine, making sure I'm taking it, making sure, you know, watching every mannerism. She films every speech I give. I call her Captain Hook, because I'll be talking and I look in the back, and it's when I'm saying enough, she'll give that hand across the neck, you know, like, okay, that's enough. I looked in the back for her. So, yeah, there's so many things, Kim. I couldn't live without her. Well, that's it in a nutshell. I guess you have to be grateful for everything, and I am. I just keep, like I always say, keep punching. And when I speak of people with intestinal fortitude, well, you're right at the top of that group. And I think that's why when we talked, our messages, we didn't have to say much, because we knew.
Yeah.
And it's been, I hope, well, it's only the beginning of us getting this word out there, because I think you're a tremendous light onto this, because people do listen to you. And I know there's a ton of people in this area listening tonight. And I'll hear it tomorrow, what a magnificent host you are, how knowledgeable. And I just hope they get your book here in the flash, Miracles Here and Beyond. And I'm not a very good reader, but I'll tell you what, that there's had me inspired. You certainly have gone through a lot. And most people would have folded, Kim, but you didn't.
Well, we have our days, like you said. We have our days.
I have one other thing to tell you. It's kind of funny. I got a call from my science teacher, and I hadn't seen him in years. He calls me up on the phone. He said, Ray, I just got your book. And you know what? I had you all wrong. I had you picked for the big house. He said, but you know what? You're doing some wonderful things. I'm proud of you. You know, that's what makes it all worth it. It's not how you start the race, it's how you finish. And I was always a good, strong finisher. So hopefully I continue to go here. And when I falter, it'll be Captain Hook telling me it's time to retire. And without her, again, wouldn't all be possible. And that's that.
And I want to encourage people to check out Ray's book. TheSecondImpact.com is his website. His book is on Amazon. But do go to The Second Impact. That's his website. You can learn more about Ray, and there is a link directly to the book on Amazon. Again, it's a great, easy but powerful read, and thank you for the plug, Ray. But definitely, you will learn a lot from the story. But for those of you, like I say, the back part of the book is full of pictures and articles, just very interesting. And Ray's gotten a number of awards, the Golden Gloves Boxing Award, and then the biggest award was, I'm sorry, Ray, what was it? In another famous boxer presented it to you. It was the
Gary Flynn Courage Award.
Yeah.
Or the Camp Goodreads Courage Award. Yeah. Those were, you know, those were all, I'm very proud of them, but the one I'm most proud of is that I'm helping people. That's the award for me. And you're right. We get some awards. But that's the biggest one.
Yep, I know it is. All right, well, we're a little bit over time. We didn't talk about the accident. There's a few things we didn't talk about, but I think we talked about all the things we were supposed to talk about tonight, and people can get the rest of it in the book. There, you know, there was one more thing I wanted to ask you, as long as we're in a little bit of overtime, and anybody who didn't hear this, it plays in its entirety on demand, so it won't stop. For anybody that quit hearing a few minutes ago, when they play it back, and they can use a slider and slide it all the way to hear the last 10 minutes if they want to. But I wanted to ask you, we talked about Andy, the attorney who actually you told the story to, and he wrote the book, and we thanked him. But I've been meaning to ask you each time we've talked, and I've forgotten. You wanted me to mention in my program notes GTX Smart Sole. I looked them up in their shoes. I could kind of tell how it was spelled, S-O-L-E, Smart Sole. But what do those shoes do that made you want to acknowledge the shoes? I got a lot of pair of shoes. You know how women are with shoes. But I never heard of these, so I wanted to know what about these GTX Smart Sole shoes? What's the deal about them?
Well, quickly, for individuals like me that get a little disoriented once in a while, that chip goes in your shoe, which allows me to be up in the back, you know, several hundred feet or so, and Patty doesn't have to be with me. She can look on her phone and see where I am. But the biggest one is that they'll stick this chip in the shoe of a child with autism. Usually they have a bracelet. But if a child gets abducted, the criminal will tear that bracelet off. They won't be looking inside that shoe. So they can track this child down. And should the shoe come off and a child is lost, well, what bigger sign is there that there's trouble than a child with one shoe off? Okay, so it's just dear to my heart. It's a tremendous finding, and I think it's going to help a lot of people, and that's why I've endorsed it heavily.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy you did, and you're no, I got it. You're kind of talking about a GPS, and the reason I wanted to mention it on the air so people can hear it is that's a great idea, and there's probably a lot of people who aren't aware, who may have a family member or that need themselves. And so I thought we'd go ahead and mention it on the air.
Well, thank you.
The program.
That'll help a lot of people, and I'm glad and happy you did that, Kim. Yeah.
I think so, too. Well, I guess what we have to say at this point is I want to thank you for being here. I appreciate having you as a guest, and I appreciate having you and Patty as new friends. And just I'm very grateful that you were here tonight and shared your message.
Yeah, I have a feeling that I've always had as a kid. And whenever I went to, you know, something that I enjoyed so much, I used to hate to see the evening end. And that's what I feel like right now. It's like we just started talking. We've been over 2 hours. I've really gotten into this, and I've enjoyed your company here and your insight. And I just can't thank you enough for all you've done.
Well, you know where to find me. Just a second here. Let me see. Yeah, I was going to say, I guess the only thing left to say, two things, keep on punching, right?
Yes, yeah.
To our audience? All right.
Yep, stay focused and keep punching. That's it. Simple.
All right. Okay, well, thank you very much, Ray Ciancaglini, for being my guest tonight. All right. I'll let you go, and good night.
Good night now. Good night to everybody. God bless.
You know where to find me. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, and right back at you. Thank you, Kim.
You bet. Good night.
Good night.
That was Ray Ciancaglini, and do check out thesecondimpact.com. Check out his book. Very informational, and again, I think you'll enjoy the pictures and the articles and various information back in his book, in the back of his book, excuse me. And I'll just tell you, happy St. Patrick's Day. Be safe. Good night. God bless. I'll be back next week. And I'm going to close tonight with something we all want to do. One of my indie musicians, this one happens to be local, Daniel Christian. You can find him at danielchristian.com. And it's Find My Voice. Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Question never seems to change. Are you with them or are you with us? And if it's true, I am not ashamed. There shouldn't be much to discuss. But for every answer that draws you near, there is an answer that will make you run. And as long as identity remains unclear, the coward will give the easy one. We can be automatic, carefully diplomatic. I need courage to speak my choice. Now that it's been a while since my courtyard denial, I am still trying to find my voice. I am still trying to find my voice. My brother is waiting to believe. We all love him just the same. There are gifts we both receive under the same sun and rain. I can't speak out of stillness, but I'm waiting to fill this space with courage to make my choice. How can we preach salvation from our own isolation? I am trying to find my voice. I am just trying to find my voice. Maybe we all have a role to play. Maybe this is my inauguration day. Until I speak. Finally getting used to my own skin. Never knew I would come this far. When you get too good at fitting in, it's hard to tell who you really are.